Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second part of the French Connection. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith, coming to you from central France. And as you know, I mentioned in the first segment that we would be having a guest from Britain. His name is Colonel Barry Turner. He's retired from the British military and somebody who's been, he's kept himself abreast of many of these issues that we've been discussing here on the French Connection for a very long time. In fact, probably a far sight longer than I've been involved in it. And it's interesting to have people like Colonel Turner on, because he can give a lot more historic roots of some of these things and some of the machinations of this particular group. David Pidcock has done his part in sharing his information, and Mohammed Rafig, and of course, you know, Felicity's a dear friend of Barry Turner's as well. But what happens is a little piece of the puzzle is added every time we get somebody like Colonel Turner on our show. So I'd like to welcome him right now. Colonel Turner, are you with me?
Yes, I am indeed, yes.
Well, it's great to have you here on the French Connection, and I want to let you know that you'll be somewhat famous as a result of this, because we do get between 10 and 15,000 people initially listening, and then quite a few more than that over time. So this attempt that we'll make today to bring some light on some dark areas of our world,
yes,
is important, because, you know, we were discussing earlier, you and I, about how this is all kind of fomented over time and how these people's network has been put into place. You want to give your take on what we're facing?
Well, it's very difficult to put a finger on, as I think everybody knows. The world is being clearly moved in a certain direction. And, you know, the straps are tightening all the time.
Yeah.
A very significant part of this, of course, currently is the Middle East. And at home, and doubtless in America as well, one reads about it in America as well, not doubtless, the population is being progressively constrained. What one is seeing is the progressive elimination of freedom of action, freedom of thought, freedom of expression. Freedom to write, the constraints on the tradition, the culture, working through that, and through, in particular, the question of race hatred, which has become almost a trigger term. And one has to sort of look at what is happening and work back to, you know, the broader field of where it's coming from. And one of the great cries, of course, and we've seen this in the last few days with the imprisonment of David Irving in Austria,
yeah,
is anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
But I believe in looking, you know, at what stares me in the face, at the facts concerning this situation,
yes,
and asking myself, you know, what is the driving force? Is it coherent? Is it cohesive? Is it monolithic? Last night, I had dinner with a couple of friends. Now, she is a most delightful person. She's totally normal, natural, not interested in anything political, racial, of any sort. Now, she came to this country at the beginning of the war as a refugee.
Yeah.
Now, I know perfectly well from conversations that her family, a lot of her family, perished in the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Now, I wouldn't. We never discuss it, but it is there, and she has no wish to discuss it. Now, you know, when one looks at the culture or the race as a whole, and its origins in this particular case from many parts of Europe, one can't see it as an entity, and I think this is where Winston Churchill, in his article, it was in fact in the Illustrated Sunday Herald of the 8th of February 1920,
mm-hmm,
where he seeks quite obviously for the what he calls the international Jew,
yes,
the revolutionary Jew, and those who are dedicated to destroying society. And he quotes very specifically the Illuminati.
Yes.
Now, this is one of those cases where we can't have it both ways. Churchill is a great global figure. He was one of the great figures of the 20th century. Can we therefore say the man was off his rocker when he starts quoting things that could well be currently condemned as anti-Semitic.
Well, you know, one of the things we brought up earlier together, and I want to clarify this now, is that the group that we've identified from our research over time is a Khazarian group what we call Ashkenazi group, and they're not even Semitically rooted.
Well, it's rather interesting. I mean, Arthur Kessler's 13th Tribe is really one of the definitive works on this.
Yeah.
Now, people like that don't put a book together like that just for the hell of it. They're not a lunatic fringe. But you see, it doesn't suit those who would rather it was not known. And it was interesting that during the various obituary comments on Kessler, his 13th Tribe wasn't mentioned. Mm-hmm. But his philandering social life was hammered at some length.
Yeah.
Now, this is tending towards the ad hominem attack, which you find all too often when the individual is attacked, not what they write or say or the evidence.
That's right.
Another good example, of course, is John Pilger.
Yes.
John Pilger is a well-known investigative journalist.
Yes.
He's written a number of books. Now, when he produced his television film, I think it was called Palestine Still the Problem, of course, it was all about Palestine. And he interviewed people from all points of view, from both sides,
mm-hmm.
from differing positions on either side. And he was roundly attacked. Now, he was attacked by a flood of correspondence from the United States, from people who'd never even seen this program.
Right.
And, of course, as you know, this is how the attack is orchestrated. It is like conducting an orchestra from all points of the world when the attack is directed at an individual not to destroy the evidence or question the evidence, but to destroy the individual.
Right.
And the head of that television channel was referred to in the Jewish Chronicle at the time as having backed the showing of the program, and then all of a sudden, for some reason, withdrawing his support and deciding, you know, this was wrong.
Right.
But
well, so what you're really saying is that they win this way, and here on the French Connection, I'm not against Jewish people. In fact, some of my dearest friends in the world and collaborators, Barry, are Jewish. My point being is that to say that I'm anti-Semitic or even anti-Jewish is an absolute bold-faced lie. I'm anti-criminal Jew, and here's the interesting thing. It would be, and this is a perfect analogy, I have a lot of Italian friends. I love their food. Yes. I love their culture. I love the way that they move their arms when they speak. I love everything about them. But I'm not crazy about a Sicilian mafia who subverts our lives. And the fact is, if I come out against the Sicilian mafia, am I being anti-Italian or... No, of course I'm not.
Absolutely. It's a very good analogy. Another angle is that none of us can help the race, color, creed, religion, or whatever to which we're born.
That's right.
It's what evolves from that. I mean, there are people, I don't know what your view is of these people, but Seymour Hersh.
Yes.
Who's rattled a few cages with the neoconservatives in the United States, Professor Noam Chomsky,
mm-hmm.
with whom I've corresponded. I mean, his book, The Fateful Triangle on the Middle East Peace Accords, is a fascinating book, and I would incline to say definitive. He's also written of world orders old and new.
Yeah.
Incidentally, he sent me a remarkable description of Prime Minister Tony Blair, which I rather treasure.
Well, I'd like to see that, by the way.
I can read it to you if you like.
Well, okay.
It's close to hand, flagged up in the file.
Well, that's okay.
Having said that,
you know something, Barry, I got to tell you something too.
Yes.
You know, when we're looking at these world leaders, some of them are placed in our path as controllers of the truth. Now, I'll give you a good example of that. Oftentimes, when we start discussing Zionist issues or criminal Jewish issues, what we've got is people from their own side working as clandestine people to try to control the things that come out.
Yes.
And it's interesting because often, just this happened on the network I was working with in America. They've got people there exposing Zionism, but they only do it after someone else broaches it. They're not researching it. They're there to control the damage.
Yes. Yeah.
And
produce a sort of almost an artificial Hegelian action and reaction.
You are exactly right.
I got this quotation,
go
by
ahead.
The way.
Yeah.
Because this guy, of course, along with your president, forms a sort of key part of the whole thing currently.
Yeah.
Chomsky says, on Blair, I guess nothing you can say could surprise me. When I happen to catch him on BBC TV somewhere or see a picture, he reminds me of nothing more than a slightly crazed six-year-old with a big grin while he plays with his new Star Wars laser gun that can wipe out everyone in sight. And when I emailed him to say, do you mind if I quote you? He said, yes, his only reservation was he was being too kind.
Well, here's the interesting thing about Mr. Blair, and this is something that the British population may not know. There was a scandal in America over a man named Gannon, and it was called Gannongate. Now, this guy turns out to be a male prostitute in Washington, D.C., which, by the way, it's illegal. Prostitution is illegal in Washington, D.C., so by the description of what he is and does, he was a criminal.
Yes.
He had unfettered access to the White House.
Yes.
He entered at his leisure under an assumed name.
Yes.
Wrote newspaper articles for a fabricated news service out of Texas, and had over 160 private visits with President Bush after hours in the White House. Now, that alone makes my stomach turn.
Yes.
But when you find out that Tony Blair had private meetings with this male prostitute, also makes my stomach retch even further.
Yes.
Now, these kinds of things that come out about people, and this is not my musing. These are documented facts.
Oh, yes, I've seen some of the reports.
And you say to yourself, what kind of people are we dealing with here, Barry?
Yes. Well, one wonders. One wonders. One really does. Another document I've got here, if I can sort of, jump sideways in the conversation, by all means sort of steer me whichever way you want to go.
No, go wherever you want to go.
I became involved with a shadow organization from South Africa in the early to mid-1990s.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bogus press office which was set up here, particularly to get evidence against Dr. Mangosuthu Buthelezi of the Inkatha Freedom Party.
Yes.
Now, one of the books that one of their staff was given to look at was Anti-Semitism, World Report 1995.
Okay.
Published by the Institute of Jewish Affairs and the American Jewish Committee. Now, this book, which is quite lengthy, 282 pages long, in fact, is an analysis, country by country, throughout the world, of the attitudes, the anti-Semitic attitudes. This is what it's after. Now, what community, what organization can be so paranoid that it will produce an analysis, clearly at great expense, taking on each country in turn to look at its anti-Semitic posture or otherwise?
Well, you know why they're doing it, Barry, and I'm going to ask you to maybe either expand on this or maybe even refute it, but the fact is that they use anti-Semitism to stop debate on other things they're doing. In other words, because they control the media, the banking, the APEC controlling our government, 65% of America's leadership role within the White House and structure within the executive branch is Jewish, including three rabbis. And when you take a look at these facts, what happens is when you look into it, they claim that you're an anti-Semite. And so what they've tried to do here is try to test the waters, as it were, to find out how they can paint people with a brush of anti-Semitism to keep them quiet about the other things they're doing.
Well, this is absolutely right. I believe in the sort of, as it were, the head count. If the evidence is there, then that is what it is all about. It's no good arguing about it and throwing back charges of anti-Semitism or anti-anything else.
That's right. But
of course, anti-Semitism, as I think is generally known now, is a trigger term.
That's
rather
right.
Like anti-apartheid. Whatever one made of the apartheid system, anti-apartheid thrown at somebody would stop any further rational thought. You were not allowed to think outside the constraints of anti-apartheid. And the same with anti-Semitism, of course. And you're back to this character demolition. But certainly, if one looks at the press in particular, all one needs to do is to find out who the key figures involved in any organ of the press, the boards of directors in our case.
There you go.
And you look at their biographies and you chart them up, rather like a game of noughts and crosses.
Yeah.
You can put the organizations across the top, if you like, and the vertical scale can be names. And you put in the crosses and see where they link up. But you see, if you think of the ill-fated Hollinger International under Conrad Black, who did he have in his board of directors? David Radler, Barbara Emil, who was a rabid Zionist, Dr. Henry Kissinger,
yeah.
Richard Pearl, I think that's been fairly well publicized,
yeah.
The Honorable Robert Strauss,
mm-hmm.
Alfred Taubman of Sotheby's,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Lord Weidenfeld of Chelsea, the publisher, who was an advisor to the early post-war Israeli governments. You have Lord Rothschild, Jacob Rothschild. You have Sir Evelyn de Rothschild. You have, incidentally, Lord Carrington, who, of course, was on the board of Kissinger Associates.
Yeah.
They went around laying out threats in Africa. You've got Rupert Hambro, the banker. Raymond Seitz, the Honorable Raymond G. Seitz. They, of course, acquired the Jerusalem Post, and under that heading, you see Major General Shlomo Gazit, former chief of military intelligence, Tel Aviv, Israel. And so it goes.
Well,
and
you know, it's not only there, because the Conrad Black's whole organization was taken over by the Bronfman family in Canada.
Yes, well, I think it wasn't Edgar Bronfman. I think it was another Bronfman who was on the board of Telegraph newspapers a bit earlier.
Yep.
And Paul Reichman, of course.
Well, of course, and you know that Vivendi organization, which was the arm from France, was a Bronfman-owned organization as well.
Yeah.
And you go through this. You take a look at Mort Zuckerman with the with U.S. News and World Report.
Yeah.
Or you can take a look at the guy named Sumner Redstone, who has got a Christian name, but his name is actually, I think, Rovenstein or something.
That happens quite a lot here.
Yeah, and so basically, when you look at every single press organ, regardless,
yes.
Sinclair Broadcasting, even Sky B's board of directors, you take a look at across every media outlet, it is
yes.
controlled by a single group.
Yes.
What do we do then?
Well, I mean, one can only say, well, here it is. You know, is it right or wrong? The situation, as one can unveil it, is something that is not exactly set in concrete, but it is there, like Hollywood. I've got a book here by J.J. Goldberg, called
mm-hmm.
Jewish Power Inside the American Jewish Establishment. It is very interesting, and it appears to be quite an honest book. Again, it's a long book. And he quite openly writes of the organizations and the power complex, not all of it homogeneous, as it were. There are variations in approach and attitude, but broadly it's an analysis of Jewish power. And here it is. The names are there, the organizations there, the statement that Harry S. Truman was dependent on their support. To become elected as president.
Yeah.
The fact that one of Bush Sr.'s protégés, who was a hot favorite to get into Congress, fell foul. I think it was because Bush started to put pressure on Israel for expanding their settlements. When Ariel Sharon is a housing minister, and all of a sudden Bush Sr.'s protégé lost his popularity and, of course, wasn't voted in. the whole thing was swung against this man because, Bush had upset the opposition. But if you go further back, you see, you take General Sir Frederick Morgan after the war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was deputy head of the United Nations Organization, Centre of Resettlement, and so on and so forth. I haven't got the exact title here. I've got his book here. Now, he was one of the overlord planners under Eisenhower. In other words, he wasn't a fool. He was clearly a man of integrity with a brain on his shoulders. If you can plan the 1944 invasion, you're no fool.
Yeah.
He identified a coherent pattern across Europe, the formerly occupied Europe, to move Jewish people, East European Jews, through Europe to Palestine. Now, I've got the press cuttings of the time, and he was taken to task for even mentioning this. And clearly, he knew what was going on.
Absolutely.
He was taken to, sent to New York to, you know, as it were, have his bottom smacked.
Mm-hmm.
And the head was the mayor of New York at the time, I seem to remember. I haven't got his name to hand without looking through the book for it. It happened again, and he was sacked. End of discussion.
Yeah.
Now, these things don't happen by accident.
No, they don't.
A great friend of mine was at the border, a major in charge of one of the border crossings. And he was called out one night by a sergeant major because there was a great kerfuffle. Now, a trainload of fit, well-dressed, well-nourished Jewish people had arrived at the crossing, and the rabbi in charge was refusing to let them go through the medical and cleansing process. And in the end, he was sort of told, you know, they either do it or we'll shoot you. And he submitted. But the point was, from Eastern Europe, where one anticipated the population to be in a death door, and they say, and everything else, starving.
Right.
Here was this trainload. I mean, that was told to me by the man who was there.
Yeah.
You take another one, which I'm sure you know about. They dare to speak out. Paul Findlay.
Yes.
When he went to Aden, as a fairly naive congressman, yes, as far as international affairs were concerned, and began to learn when he was in Aden what was going on and the truth about Israel and the Middle East. And of course he then found himself, when he started making noises, unseated.
That's right.
And here it is, a hardback book with the whole story. If you go further on, or further back rather, to the Middle East Wars of 67 and 73.
Yes.
A very good book was published by Christopher Mayhew, a government minister under Harold Wilson, and Michael Adams, a reputable journalist who died recently. Publish it not, The Middle East Cover-Up.
Mm-hmm.
There again, you find there's this coherent pattern of influence within the media, behind the media, putting enormous pressure on at a high level to suppress any favorable reporting as far as the Palestinians are concerned.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Arabs.
Yeah.
And when somebody like an ex-government minister puts his name to a book and co-authors it, then it has to be so. Now, the Guardian newspaper, which is one of our principal newspapers in this country, then the Manchester Guardian, was almost bankrupted when its advertising was withdrawn, and here you have another clue.
Mm-hmm.
And a paper in South Wales was bankrupted as a result of this pressure. Now, these things don't happen by accident.
Well, you know, I've seen repeated evidence of the same thing throughout my research, and the facts are very clear to me when you look at it. But here's the reasoning behind what they're doing. There is a goal that they have to get every Jew in Europe to leave the mainland of Europe and go to Israel, as well as American Jews. Now,
yeah.
How do they do that? How do they do it? Well, they do it by fomenting the problems that we've just been discussing, and then getting an exodus of these people with their cash in hand, with their things, and here's the interesting thing. They've even got America footing the bill for the exodus, and they're it's amazing. And even the resettlement, even the purchasing of homes, even and all of it. And yet, when you take a look at the event of 67's Liberty attack, USS Liberty.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And here's what shocks me. Not the fact that the Israelis did that. I would expect that kind of behavior from them, knowing what I know. What shocked me about reading about the USS Liberty was the response of the American government, or the non-response of the government,
yes.
And then the subsequent cover-up of the U.S. government, which told me more about the relationship than anything else could have.
Well, yes, I agree. I mean, I have a book written on the USS Liberty, and I've followed the press reports as they occur, and there aren't many, as you know. It's not allowed to be publicized. Yes, the total inertia in doing anything about it. I mean, who on earth is pulling the strings in a case like that? I mean, if you look at Israel and what it did to the USS Liberty, and if you look at it in, shall we say, statistical terms, it's a country of about 5 million.
Yeah.
It is outside the nuclear non-proliferation treaty.
That's right.
It seems to be immune from UN censure through resolutions like 242 and 338, I think they are.
Well, there have been actually General Assembly resolutions against them in the many dozens. None of them have ever been followed. That's right.
Yeah. But you see, a country that size should be a tourist center and exporting oranges and bananas. No way should it be a world power which has America by the nose. I mean, these are my conclusions. I started this entire thing 20 years ago with a totally open mind and a great deal of admiration for what Israel had achieved. And, of course, the people of Israel are just as vulnerable. The people born there since the mass immigration after the war didn't choose to be born there. And in many ways, as John Pilger identified, they're victims, along with everybody else.
Mass mind control.
Oh, well, mass mind control, yes. But you see, if you go back even further, you find, and again, areas of history that are covered up, documents on German foreign policy, 1918 to 1945. Now, after the war, the British foreign policy and German foreign policy documents were collated and translated, and both series were, I suppose, about a dozen very thick, very well-published hardback books.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Series D, 1937 to 45, Volume 5, Poland, the Balkans, Latin America, the smaller powers, June 1937 to March 1939, and that contains details of the collaboration with the Zionists to evacuate selected Jews and their money to Palestine. Now, the discussion is in these documents. Now, this was Hitler, whatever one makes him, he's a pretty ghastly sort of individual. But they were determined to get the Jews to move to other countries.
Yeah.
Various countries that are discussed, and what the implications were for the Palestinians and for Palestine were discussed. But you see, it is a part of history where Germany was trying to move Jews to Palestine. Now, this was the era, of course, of the concentration camps, and they're not exactly the pleasantest of places in those days. In fact, quite the reverse, as we know perfectly well.
Mm-hmm.
But they were trying to move Jews out.
That's right.
And it involved the British government as well. So there are other facets to this.
Well, including a whole boatload of Jews that were actually placed on a German ship and shipped out of Germany and then sent actually to the United States and refused entry.
Yes.
And what they did when they got refused entry there, because that was the destination, they forced that ship, they resupplied it in New York, and then
yes.
shipped these people to Palestine.
Yes.
Now, yep. they've made a story out of that, saying that, they sent this boatload of people wandering, but when you take a
yes.
look at who made these decisions, it was the Jewish elite that were deciding where these people were going to end up.
Yes. They were already influential, as we know at that time, very influential, both sides of the Atlantic.
One of the people that I've been pushing pretty hard here is Benjamin Friedman. Why? Ben Friedman, aside from being Jewish himself, was able to give a first person account of Baruch and Untermeyer and Morgenthau and others who came over for that Balfour signing.
Yes.
And he was there, this man, Friedman.
Yeah.
And his discussions on just how deep this conspiracy goes are bone chilling. And
yes.
I got to tell you, I put his audio file on my website. It's been downloaded to the number of 23,000 to date.
Yes.
Now, that's 23,000 people throughout the world who have heard a real powerful truth that is life-changing.
Yes.
And I don't know if you remember listening to it for the first time. It must have changed your life as well. It changed mine.
Well, I mean, it's as one learns, one begins, you know, the parts of the jigsaw begin to fall into place.
Yeah.
And there's so much we haven't been told.
Yeah.
I've got another translation here, and this is from the Soviet Military Encyclopedia, Volume 7, 1979. Now, very few copies of the Soviet Military Encyclopedia ever escaped from Russia.
Mm-hmm.
They let these out at about that time, 1979, and they had to be translated. And, of course, the Marx, the Soviet military doctrine, politico-military doctrine, its interpretation, the Marxist language was very convoluted, so it wasn't a straight literal translation, and within that, of course, one could interpret what they were saying, and they had Zionism sussed out. It's far too long to read, of course.
Well, what is synopsis of it?
What?
What is the synopsis you've arrived at?
Well, Zionism, an extreme reactionary ideology, a ramified system of organizations and policies expressing the interests of the cosmopolitan Jewish bourgeoisie and closely linked with the monopolistic circles of the USA and other imperialist states. I mean, that's the opening paragraph. And that gives you a fair amount to...
Oh, boy. And you know, I can't find any fault in any of that.
The fundamental matter of contemporary Zionism manifests itself in unbridled chauvinism, racism, malicious anti-communism, and anti-Sovietism.
Of course, now that I have a question with, because they actually designed communism.
Oh, yes.